I'm always trying to tell you everything that I want you to know in the whole wide world in one lecture. And that's kind of what I'm doing today. So, what we're going to talk about is severe neonatal jaundice or hyperbilirubinemia, acute bilirubin encephalopathy, and its progression to Kernicterus spectrum disorder. The only disclosure I have is a book called Springer Nature, Pediatric Procedural Pearls, a Case-Based Guide. And we co-edited and wrote that with people from all over the world. And we turn any the teeny-weeny royalties we get back into global health. So I had my beginning in Africa in 1989 at Eku Baptist Hospital. It was a 168-bed hospital, about 44 pediatric beds. About half of those were neonates. And the two main problems we were seeing in neonates were neonatal tetanus. And our center actually had a better survival rate than most at 20%. And then severe neonatal jaundice with acute bilirubin encephalopathy. Well, back then I said tetanus will go away, and it almost has. Not quite, especially not in places like northern Nigeria, but it's pretty well gone. And I thought it would with immunizations, but we didn't seem to know much about severe neonatal jaundice. And so I chose to leave private practice and head back to a fellowship so I could go to Africa and study problems like severe neonatal jaundice. Several years ago now, we did a population-based study where we looked at severe neonatal jaundice based on clinical markers of acute bilirubin encephalopathy, exchange transfusion, and neonatal death that was jaundice-related. And you say, why did you do that? And it was because many people were not able to do a total serum bilirubin or labs at all. And we looked at every article we could find. Unfortunately, 76% of those articles that had population-based data were from high-income countries. But, as you can see, Africa and Southeast Asia led the pack in terms of burden of disease, with Africa having 668 cases of severe neonatal jaundice per 10,000 live births. We weren't very happy with that study, though, again, because it didn't really tell us much about low and middle income countries. So we went back and did another systematic review and meta-analysis, but this time we looked at neonatal hospital admissions. And once again, Africa and Southeast Asia had the largest burden of disease. And this time, 76% of the studies were from low and middle income countries. And then even more recently, we helped Lagos University Teaching Hospital analyze their 3,000 neonatal admissions and those that died. And as you can see, 12% of their neonatal death was jaundice related, which is just unheard of. Except that in Kano, in northern Nigeria, they have almost exactly the same stats. And in their case, 11% of the deaths are from neonatal jaundice. Just hard to believe. Now, there might be, I don't think there's anybody as old as I am in the room, but there might be one or two closer. And so the folks that are about my age, you can use Kernicterus for everything. You can call everything Kernicterus that's related to bilirubin damage. But for all the rest of you, which is almost everybody in the room, I want you to use the correct terminology for 2024. And so that means you don't call acute bilirubin encephalopathy in the first weeks of life Kernicterus. You call that acute bilirubin encephalopathy. And that's characterized by poor feeding and suck, as everything in neonates is. Advancing levels of stupor, hypertonia and epispotonus, a real high-pitched cry, and then, yes, kernicteric facies. We developed that term before ABE came along. But kernicteric facies is a kid where that has paralysis of upward gaze, often referred to as sunsetting, something like you would see in a kid with hydrocephalus, eyelid retraction, facial dystonia. If you look at that kid, he looks scared or stunned or anxious, and then sometimes they have disconjugate gaze. In 2024, don't call it BIND. Remember, call it ABE, acute bilirubin encephalopathy, and use BIND or the modified BIND as the scoring system for babies that have acute bilirubin encephalopathy. If you use the old BIND, there's three categories: mental status, which starts at sleepy but arousable and moves to apnea and coma; muscle tone, which starts with hypotonia and then mixed hypo-hypertonia, and then increasingly arching of the neck, retrocollis, epispotonus, and crossing or scissoring of the arms and legs, but without trismus. And kids who have a BIND score of 1 to 3 are mild, and if you treat them quickly, you won't know they had it later on. 4 to 6 is moderate, and some parts may be reversible with treatment. And once you get above 7 or above, we don't think the symptoms actually reverse. And there you will see Professor Ola doing a startle on that baby. And you'll notice the baby's arms go out, but they basically never come back in or take a very, very, very long time to come back in. The other thing is, this cry is extremely irritating, and I can't stand there or sit there and listen to it for very long. So, baby, some of the neurotoxicity risk factors for ABE are hemolytic disease, asphyxia, significant lethargy, significant clinical instability in the past 24 hours, temp instability, acidosis, sepsis, and an albumin of less than 3. And then if we talk about what are the causes of hyperbilirubinemia or elevated total serum bilirubin and extreme hyperbili, we basically have 3 categories, and those are increased production, decreased clearance, and increased intrahepatic circulation. Increased production, classically, we think about things like ABO incompatibility and rhesus disease. Erythrocyte enzymatic defects include things like G6PD deficiency, inherited red cell membrane defects like spherocytosis, polycythemia, birth injuries like cephalohematoma or subgaleal hemorrhage, and then TORCH, sepsis including TORCH or urinary tract infections. One thing you need to recognize is the regional differences in etiologies of severe neonatal jaundice. If you look at this map, the darker the green, the higher the incidence of G6PD deficiency in male infants they screened. There are more up-to-date maps, but this one's easier to read and they haven't changed. But if you'll notice, for much of sub-Saharan Africa, 15 to 26% of their male infants are G6PD, or their males are G6PD deficient. And it's been 3 decades since the World Health Organization told us we needed to do G6PD screening, but we don't because we can't afford it. All right. And actually, we're not even doing it in the U.S., and we know that 13% of our African-American males are G6PD deficient. And it's for another topic, but I think if it was 13% of Caucasians, we would be doing G6PD screening in the U.S. at least. But there's no low-cost test right now to do that. G6PD deficiency is the most common cause of severe neonatal jaundice in sub-Saharan Africa. You might remember from school that it's X-linked, and it's the most common enzymatic disorder of red cells in humans. About 400 million people worldwide, and males are homozygous, but females, heterozygotes, can have either normal, moderately reduced, or grossly deficient enzyme activity, and they too can develop ABE from G6PD. Something else that's common in certain other places is Rh incompatibility. The incidence varies from 2.4 to 13% depending on the study and the country. But anti-RHD is not administered in 50% of the eligible cases worldwide. It results in 160,000 perinatal deaths and 100,000 cases of disability annually. And that represents only a 50% decrease relative to the era before we had immunoglobulin administration. That's mind-boggling. And then there's decreased clearance with things like Gilbray's, hypoalbuminemia or disruption or obstruction in the biliary system. And then there's increased intrahepatic circulation. Breast milk jaundice is in that category. Don't get it confused with breastfeeding jaundice, which is primarily from not getting enough breast milk. And then another cause is intestinal obstruction. But I would challenge you to say, yeah, those are the biochemistry and heme reasons to have jaundice. But what are the real reasons or causes of extreme hyperbile leading to ABE in low-resource settings and ultimately to severe neonatal jaundice? And I would tell you that the real reasons are parents' failure to recognize jaundice and seek care, coupled with harmful practices in neonates that provoke hemolysis in G6PD deficiency, and babies with Rh incompatibility and Rh disease who aren't picked up early enough. And with Rh disease, the mothers don't get immunoglobulin. There's also a real inability to screen babies needing treatment and to measure TSB in an accurate, timely way. And there's inadequate access to effective phototherapy. Can we change those things? Well, I actually think we can. For one thing, if you're working or living in sub-Saharan Africa, you really, until we can G6PD screen everybody, you need to be telling every pregnant mom to avoid things like mentholated dusting powder, henna, eucalyptus oil, mentholatum, naphthalene, camphor, all those kind of things in their baby for the first few months of life. It's fine to use it once the baby's skin gets tough, but don't use it in the neonatal period. If we think that our mothers understand severe neonatal jaundice, they don't. This is just a few of the studies that I chose to stick in this slide. But these are studies from Ghana, Nigeria, China, and Ethiopia. In every one of these papers, mothers had serious gaps in their understanding of neonatal jaundice, how to recognize it, how to treat it, what to do, what problems it could cause. So the first thing that we can do to impact the incidence of severe neonatal jaundice is educate our mothers and our healthcare workers. But in this study, you'll see that in our jaundiced babies, the percent who had acute bilirubin encephalopathy dropped from almost 91% all the way down to 1.7%, and the only difference was maternal education antenatally with postpartum reinforcement. That's dramatic. Some people are listening. The World Health Organization now has added a little bit about maternal education and asking mothers to come back if they notice jaundice in their babies, and that's good. Nigeria's done an even better job because they've been more specific in what they tell us to say, and they ask us to bring our babies back for follow-up between day 3 to 5. Look for risk factors. Make sure that mothers know their blood group. Many of them don't. And Rh during the antenatal period, and then to avoid hemolytic agents like camphor. I'm really hopeful that all countries will follow suit. There's also, as I said a minute ago, a big need for low-cost, easy-access RHD programs. That will require a combination of physicians and health workers, international agencies, manufacturers of prophylactic agent or rhesus immunoglobulin, health policy makers, and governments in low and middle income countries. Some countries are doing a great job, but we've got a long way to go. And then, how in the heck do we screen for jaundice? I'm sad to tell you that many people are still stuck with the Kramer scale, which has been around at least since the 1960s. We know that yellowness or jaundice moves from the head down and out, except the eyeballs are a sign of severe jaundice. They aren't great. Kramer scale isn't wonderful, but it is better than nothing, telling you which kids have a bilirubin of more than 15 milligrams per deciliter. You need to look at the baby in very good light, preferably daylight. And all babies with jaundiced eyeballs and palms and soles must have a bilirubin, and any baby with jaundice in the first 24 hours needs a bilirubin. Lots of people are working on ways to screen that are low cost and easy to find. This is a couple, Bilistrip 1 and 2 for moms and clinic workers. The Bilistrip 2 can be used with a cell phone and a Billy app to determine the total bilirubin. And then there's the Billy Pick, which is also a cell phone app where you get an actual plasma bilirubin. And that has data sharing via the internet. And you can see that's a pretty doggone good correlation between total serum bilirubin from the Billy Pick and laboratory. Now, I'm not going to take too long because I don't want to run out of time, but anybody want to shout out what they see as a problem with this A? I'll point out there's one baby, two babies, three babies, and that's your phototherapy unit. What? And they do actually have eye shields. It's just hats that's covering up too much of the baby. Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute. What about this one, B? These are white fluorescent bulbs, two of them. All right. Keep thinking. This one is three babies. Now, this phototherapy unit was made for three babies. But look at what those babies are laying on. And look at how much of the baby is covered up between the nappy and the eye shield. This is also a pretty good light, but look how far it is above the baby. And we know that the farther away, the less of radiance you get. All right, and I'm going to tell you on this one, three babies laying on a dark cloth. They need to be laying on white because white reflects, dark absorbs, and they need to have their nappy either off or rolled way, way down. Same thing, they need smaller eye shields. Fluorescent bulbs shouldn't be used in 2024. And these babies, while this is great phototherapy, no baby is getting ideal because they're laying the wrong way. And then talk about phototherapy. The way you tell if phototherapy is good is to measure the irradiance level. And if you have an irradiance level below about 10 microwatts per centimeter squared per nanometer, you have what I like to call fake phototherapy. And so you need an irradiance of 10 and above to even have any phototherapy. And to have intensive phototherapy, you need an irradiance of at least 30 microwatts per centimeter squared per nanometer. And you'll look here. In Nigeria, 38% were less than 5. So 38% were absolutely fake. And this was a bunch of different kinds of hospitals. In Cameroon, not a single unit we tested was above 5. In Bangalore, India, about a third of their units weren't okay. And then Goodman, look at this. Is the Netherlands a high-income country or a low? Yeah, it's high. And 50% of their devices were delivering less than 10. So we went back and checked it in Minnesota. I'm happy to tell you in Minnesota we had no fake. But we did have some phototherapy that was not intensive, which we have subsequently remedied. And why does that matter? It matters because the higher the irradiance, the faster the bilirubin drops, the higher the irradiance. Now, I do also want to point out that no matter how good your phototherapy is, irradiance declines over time. Now, if you have good LED bulbs, that time may be 10 years. If you have white fluorescent bulbs, it may be a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, okay? And yes, you can still read from those lights, but they are not giving any phototherapy at all. So know your unit and test it. And this NeoBlue, I'll point out, was a donated unit. When it came, it would have had 30, 40. Now it's down in the low 20s. And then I showed you those babies, if you'll remember in A, the baby that were not in the middle. Footprint matters. So you need to be laying in the center of the phototherapy. You'll see the irradiance in the orange is higher there. Again, the closer the light to the baby, the higher the irradiance. You do need to be aware of things like heat in deciding how close you can bring. And then you absolutely need an irradiance meter. And I'm begging every biomedical engineer I know to come up with a low-cost irradiance meter that works, because this thing here costs several thousand dollars. And so we need a low-cost irradiance meter. Otherwise, you don't know what you're doing. You look at the light, you think it's on, you think it's working, and it's terrible. High-quality phototherapy, usually in 2024 with LEDs, can be manufactured commercially and also locally. Dr. Clark Sleeth, who works in Kenya, makes a phototherapy, a high-quality LED for less than $50 a unit. If you need one, email me and I'll connect you with him and he'll try to get you one. And so improvements in phototherapy can be made and are happening in India, Africa, and around the world. And when you don't have electricity, you can think about filtered sunlight phototherapy. We've shown it to be safe and effective in mild and moderate to severe jaundice. You do need to use a tested filter, and we're working now on a way for mothers and community health extension workers to be able to tell when the baby is hot or cold, which is the next piece of widely implementing filtered sunlight more than we're already doing. Ideally, we would use it in combination with a solar-powered unit for nighttime, but we'll hopefully get further along. And then some of you U.S. folks know that in 2022, the American Academy of Peds finally came up with updated hyperbilirubinemia guidelines. way overdue, but thankfully they tell you all, if you're working in a low middle income country, please do not use the American Academy of Pediatric Guidelines. Because what is the first word in that? America. Does that say Kenya? Does it say Uganda? Does it say China? No. Okay? So the AAP this time screamed in those guidelines that all countries need to develop their own guidelines based on specific risk and resources. It's going to be different if you can't get a bilirubin back for 3 days. It's going to be different if you don't have any electricity more than 2 hours a day if you're lucky. It's going to be different if you cannot get blood for an exchange transfusion. I can go on and on and on. If your phototherapy has an irradiance of 10, you're not going to be able to wait as long as we can wait in the U.S. Does that make sense? So please don't take these new guidelines to Africa and use them without adaptations. Now, I will also point out that Myanmar has done a package that included an irradiance meter, education, and intensive phototherapy, and their exchange transfusions have dropped by 69%. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but one suggestion I have is to consider sticking with the 2004 guidelines, eliminating low risk, because unless you can do G6PD screening, nobody's low risk. So consider your babies to be moderate to high risk while you're working on developing your own guidelines for the countries you work in. And then keep in mind that preemies are not term, and we do worry more about phototherapy toxicity in the micro preemies, the 500 to 750 grammers, who are surviving more in Africa and other LMICs than they used to. But there is probably a trade-off between better neurological function with phototherapy and a tiny increase in death in these kids with phototherapy, so you got to balance it, especially in these tiny ones. Nobody has great guidelines for preemies, but this is one guideline. The bottom line is prepare for an exchange, and the top line is conduct it, and then again consider phototherapy at the lower level and use it at the higher level. There is also a tool for babies less than or equal to 34 weeks. It's pretty cool, but can't use it in the first 48 hours. And if you are going to use it, you still need to adapt it to your country, because this is a Stanford American tool. Also want you to remember that bilirubin is an antioxidant, and that's no matter whether you're in Nigeria or Uganda or America. It does protect against things like coronary artery disease. That's why some of our kids, our grown-ups with Gilbrays, do better than the rest of us. It also protects against peripheral vascular disease, chronic kidney disease, autoimmune conditions, and cancer. So it's not all bad. So it's really figuring out the balance and when you treat and when you don't treat. There have been a few studies that show a tiny, tiny increased risk with phototherapy in term babies, just the tiniest increase in childhood seizures, and not really, but some people have worried about maybe an increase in asthma, atopic disease, things like that. But none of those have been shown to be conclusively a problem. But we are looking harder now to figure out problems that could be associated with phototherapy. Now, I think it's not going to be very long at all before we have prescription phototherapy based on a whole list of factors, including the gestational age of the baby, how old the baby is, the bilirubin level, baby sick or not sick, does the baby have those risk factors for ABE, including ethnicity, do they have signs of ABE, and what quality of phototherapy do you have? And I made up some examples, but I think what we do for the 750 grammar who is otherwise well, and the bilirubin's 3 milligrams, we're probably going to start them at a lower irradiance, in stark contrast to the 2.7 kilo baby who has signs of ABE with a new onset blank stare, alternating hypertonia and hypotonia, neck arching, you're going to go ahead and do high-quality intensive phototherapy on that child. So, when phototherapy isn't enough, you do an exchange blood transfusion. And even the new guidelines in the U.S. and every other guideline tell you if a child has acute bilirubin encephalopathy, it doesn't matter what the bilirubin is, you should do an exchange transfusion or an exchange blood transfusion, as I sometimes call it. Now, I'll be honest, we don't know if we're helping that child with a BIND score of 9. We may be doing this exchange for no reason. And I'm probably not going to fight as hard with that mother if they don't have the money or whatever or just don't want to do it, because probably we're not changing much. But we'll try. We'll try it. But in that baby with the bilirubin of 3 or 4, I mean not bilirubin, fine score of 3 or 4, we may change everything for that baby's future by doing an exchange transfusion quickly. We also worry about babies whose bilirubins are rising faster than 0.2 milligrams per deciliter per hour or 5 milligrams per deciliter per day despite intensive phototherapy with a total serum bilirubin nearing exchange levels. And then, of course, do an exchange if the level is above that for an exchange. This is the similar graph to the one I showed you a minute ago. This is the exchange graph, though. And again, I'd get rid of the low risk and use the high risk or moderate risk until you're able to get your own in-country guidelines. And for some places, for instance, Nigeria, there's going to be a few centers that do have quick bilirubins, a generator with 24/7 electricity, and high-quality phototherapy. So there may be two sets of guidelines in Nigeria, one for those hospitals and one for the other hospitals with the problems with electricity, labs, blood, etc. Now, for the exchange transfusion, there are a couple resources. One is the book I mentioned to you at the beginning as a potential conflict of interest. It's the Procedural Adaptation for Low Resource Settings, and that comes as both a hard copy and an electronic copy. There's also the Sugar Pearls videos. Those are totally free, and I've got the link there. And then after you do your exchange blood transfusion, put your neonate back under intensive phototherapy, recheck the bilirubin at the end of the exchange, then again in 6 hours, and then determine how often you need them. There is the link at the bottom of this page for the book, and on that is also the other procedures that are in that book. Now, as we'll say to you loudly when we do our workshops tomorrow, never use a book like this or Sugar Prep to learn how to do the exchange. Learn from one of your Nigerian or Ugandan or Kenyan or wherever you're working colleagues or from a neonatologist in the States. But if you need guidelines on how to do the procedure that you already know how to do with high-income country resources, you can go to these resources. And this is a picture of the first step of a two-stopcock method. In the U.S., we have a 360-degree stopcock, which allows us to keep turning, never disconnecting, never introducing infection. We don't have actual exchange transfusion stopcocks in any of the countries I've worked in Africa. So what we do is two stopcocks. So they're stopcock, and this is a sterile feeding tube. And it costs about $1 as opposed to $125 for an actual umbilical venous catheter. It's sterile, and so we use a sterile feeding tube, and then we hook it to two stopcocks. This is the syringe from the baby and back to the baby. That's the discard, which is just a piece of IV tubing, and this goes to your blood bag. So basically, you pull from the baby, discard it, draw from the blood bag, give back to the baby, and start all over. And those procedures are in the resources I showed you on the last slide. And then you can use something like this AAP escalation of care, and it does give you an idea of other labs you should get if you can, like a CBC, albumin, chemistries, and how to escalate, which we just talked about. And then in babies with severe neonatal jaundice, they need to have a brainstem-evoked auditory response because hearing loss is the most common sequelae of bilirubin toxicity. And if you pick it up early, you can really help these kids overcome that handicap. It damages the brainstem, auditory nuclei, auditory nerve, and spiral ganglia, and so needs to be screened. And this is kind of a summary of the strategies to overcome barriers to prevent acute bilirubin encephalopathy. Again, seeking care, you have to educate your parents in antenatal clinics and reinforce it postpartum. You have to educate healthcare workers about problems with jaundice, how to screen, how to treat. We need non-invasive screening tests for parents and healthcare workers, icterometers, smartphone enhanced icterometers, dedicated instruments to look at things like the conjunctiva and nail bed. Then we need invasive plasma bilirubin assays. It's kind of bad when you're still doing an exchange based on a Kramer scale and not a bilirubin level. We need referral networks so that you know where to send your jaundiced baby, and then effective phototherapy with appropriate in-country guidelines. But what do we do about the children who don't have access to these measures? Well, I've already told you that somewhere in the big cities in Nigeria, in Kano and Lagos, 11 to 12% of their babies have jaundice-related death. So some of them die, but what about the ones who don't die? I want you to meet David from northern Nigeria. That is not his real name. David has chorioathetoid cerebral palsy. He has trouble walking and talking. But what about his IQ? How many in the room are going to say it's below normal? How many are going to say it's normal? Above normal. Could be. Okay? The truth of the matter, and why did you make that choice? Somebody, who's the youngest person who raised their hand? Why did you make that choice? Anybody, shout it out. Where does bilirubin affect? What part of the brain? Anybody? Sue? Yeah. Brainstem, the basal ganglia. It doesn't affect the cortex. And I know I've not been in medical school for a long time, but I believe the cortex is where our intelligence lives. So these kids actually have whatever IQ they were born with before they got jaundiced, okay? So he has Kernicterus, but now we're all going to remember, since you all are younger than I am, that we should be calling it Kernicterus spectrum disorder. They usually have normal intelligence, but they're often trapped in a body that doesn't work. More than 83% of the survivors of KSD had one or more impairments. Kernicterus spectrum disorder, you can have one of these chronic manifestations. You can have all of them. So you can have chorioathetoid CP, gaze abnormalities. That paralysis of upward gaze doesn't always go away with beyond the neonate. They may have it their whole life and learn to compensate by moving their head. Language processing disorder, sensorineural hearing loss, and dental enamel dysplasia. Now, that does go away when you get your permanent teeth. It's not lifelong, but I'd like to go to dental clinics and see how many little people have that. There are better ways than there used to do of predicting severe disease in these kids. We did find out that doing an MRI, even if you have one, is not a reliable predictor in the newborn period of who will develop KSD. But a brain MRI at 3 months or 12 months can confirm KSD. The modified BIND that I mentioned to you score obtained at admission for neonatal hyperbilirubinemia is a valuable screening tool as long as you know how to do it. And the Berry All Right Dystonia scale and brain MRI also can be used together as early as 3 months to tell you which kids will go on to have KSD. There's also a Kernicterus toolkit. It can be used in older patients with comparable sensitivity and specificity to the BIND score. It can be used in resource-limited settings without the need for an MRI or ABR testing, and it can be used in cases you're wondering, does that kid have KSD or something else? Now, I want to show you, with permission, a couple of videos that kind of bring home what I said about, these are clips used with permission, but what these kids trapped in a body that doesn't work.
Family.
Oscar's a bit of a foodie.
Yeah.
Sometimes I sneak him a snack when I take him for a pee during school break because I go into school because they want to hoist him, so it takes 40 minutes and I just lift him and it takes 4. So there's sometimes a sneaky snack during the powder break. After Dublin in 2014, the next year the conference, the summit, global summit for young leaders was in Bangkok. And Oscar was asked to make a presentation. So that was a bit of a shock too, wasn't it, Oscar? And he spoke about what it was like to be on the inside looking out and how he perceived the world looking at him. And much of it was that they look and they don't see.
They look and they don't see. They look and they don't see.
How old are you married?
About to be 2 years.
2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How's that going? Through a program playing wheelchair basketball.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you still
people
wheelchair basketball?
Always.
I am a website
designer. I'm also a network
security,
as well as video editor.
We actually got him on. But then there's that problem. You know, you need the sunglasses, but then your head's... but since we never had a Billy, we don't know how high it got. We don't know at what point she got the hit to her basal ganglia, but we figured it out. We actually had to figure it out ourselves. It took about a year and a half. It's just been a battle ever since. This is a kid who has a documented IQ of 160. She was reading before she was a year old and has never really been able to speak a very intelligible word. Occasionally, she'll be able to say a phrase or two or three words just out of the blue, but if you ask her to say it again, she can't say it. She can't repeat it. But she won the national French exam for, like, several years in a row, even though she can't talk. And she's just a remarkable, incredibly intelligent kid.
And so you notice those kids have things like fancy wheelchairs, and they have things like feeding tubes, lifts, hoists, and all kinds of fancy equipment, because the kids in this video are from high-income countries. And this kid's using an eye gaze computer that talks for him.
So to have expensive engagement to be able to do this using eye gaze, which he wasn't able to do before, is really very, very exciting.
Jess had a great talk to give you, but when he tries to speak in front of a group or tries really hard, his dystonia kicks in.
Hi. I blew up.
We hear stories about, you know, a village in Nigeria that managed to do a radio ad for free.
Do not give them short shrift. I mean, these kids are bright. They need to be given every opportunity to succeed, engage, communicate, excel. And so many of us, when our kids were diagnosed, we were given very low expectations. And I would say, I'm not too sure where you learned that. But I would say that's the wrong message, and that to really empower our kids, give them every service they need, give them the technology to communicate, and expect them to achieve.
How old are you, Mary?
About 22 years.
2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Hold on.
Okay, again, those are kids from high-income countries with all kinds of technology at their fingertips, all right? And it's still a really sad disease. You can see from those kids, people don't see them, okay? People assume they're stupid, et cetera, et cetera. But they have a lot more than John Paul. John Paul is from Nigeria. He's actually hoping to go to university soon. John Paul has Kernicterus spectrum disorder. His brother died from acute bilirubin encephalopathy. His other brother has no arms and one short leg from medicine the mother took probably during pregnancy. But back to John Paul. He has KSD. He and even those more damaged have no special devices to make study easier. Life is hard in Nigeria for most everyone, but even harder for children with disabilities like John Paul. But thanks to John Paul's faith and his mother, who has pushed him all his life to succeed, he is hoping to go to university soon. Pray that he can, and pray that others will look and see him. What John Paul tells me, along with his mother, is they don't even think I'm human. They don't even think he's human, okay? He's something else, he's whatever. And I will tell you a special prayer request that just came last night. I don't usually do this, of course, in a lecture, but I'm going to in this group. John Paul's mother, who has pushed John Paul and his brother without arms and with the short leg, Stephen, is going blind from diabetes. And I would just ask, she called me last night, and she needs laser surgery. Pray that we can find that in Nigeria and that she can see, because she is the reason these boys have accomplished all that they've accomplished along with God's help. Coming, her name is Blessing, so if anybody wants to remember her. But coming soon from Nigeria, we're going to have John Paul's story and the story of other kids. We're calling it Beyond Statistic, The Faces of Kernicterus. Stories from children, their families, healthcare providers, and policymakers. We all need to be insisting on a comprehensive, contextualized package of education for all, screening, accurate, rapid diagnosis, appropriate in-country guidelines for treatment, effective phototherapy and follow-up for those with kernicterus spectrum disorder. It's a package worth implementing as we look to a world without ABE and KSD. And with that, I will see if you have any questions. Any questions about jaundice management or management of kids with KSD? I will tell you, I see Sue here. Physical therapy and physical therapy early is extremely important to these kids. And the earlier you start it and the more intense it is, the better they do long haul. It's not perfect. Otherwise, those high-income kids would be doing better if it was just a matter of physical therapy, but it can help, yeah.
I just had a question about the G6P screening. And talk about women to advocate it even for people in the US. So my family and I, we work in Chad, Africa. Mm-hmm. Everyone takes some water medicines. My husband and I were tested for G6P before we took it. But it was really hard to get it for even our kids in the United States. And so we were looking like other labs or anything like that. And even for like the kids that are in Chad, do you have any like recommendations for finding the best place to get
It's probably going to be in one of your capital cities at a teaching hospital, but there is an extremely low-cost screening test, and that's what it is. It's called a fluorescent spot test, okay? And it doesn't require, it only costs about 10 cents, but it requires somebody who knows something about lab to actually do it, but it's very cheap, and actually it's what we're using in many places in Nigeria. It doesn't come back super quick because you have to batch it, because you have to compare the color change between, you can't just do a single test, you need to do at least 5 or 10 tests to be able to see the kid who's deficient and doesn't fluoresce versus the kid who has it and who is sufficient and has it. There was also a CareStart test that only cost about $1.50 and was only available in low and middle income countries, but they quit making it because they started making COVID tests. And unless they've just brought it back, it's not back. And there are other tests like the CareStart, but they cost $35 a test or more, and so they're not cost, they're too expensive to use. There's some tests, there's a machine called Babies that will give you quantitative testing, but again, way too expensive to use in a low middle income country. So right at the moment, the only thing we can afford to use outside of a research setting in most of our places is a fluorescent spot test. And you can teach somebody to do it. I mean, in an unknown country that I won't tell you where or who, we taught somebody who was not a lab tech how to do it, how to read it, and I absolutely believe that she can and did. So you can, if you had somebody like yourself, teach somebody how to do it. But it's not, yeah. But once they're set up, if you're seeing enough kids to run 10 at a time or something, you could use it. I can send you a list of the reagents. Troy Lund at our hospital orders the reagents from them. You can get the reagents from, Ed Boss. What's his lab thing?
Worldwide
Lab. He can get the reagents for you. Somebody else can get the reagents for you. I can send you a list of the reagents and how to do it and mix it up and that sort of thing. Of course, when you do it in a neonate, if they're deficient, they're deficient, they're deficient. But if you do it in a neonate and it's sufficient and you still suspect it, you need to repeat it. Because remember, newborn babies have lots of extra new red cells, and that's where G6PD is. So if you think they're deficient and they test sufficient, you'll need to repeat it. In 6 weeks or 12 weeks or something like that. But if they're deficient, you do not need to repeat it because you don't revert. If you're deficient, you stay deficient. And by the way, that's another terminology. You can tell occasionally you can tell I'm ancient because sometimes I say G6PD positive and negative. You should not be using that terminology anymore. Just be very specific and say sufficient and deficient. Anything else? Any comments, questions?
I get a lot of requests for the Billy scanner in African countries. What, the Draeger or the meters? What's your thoughts?
Oh, I love the Draeger. Okay, I love the JM-105. It's wonderful, and the nice thing about it is it does not require any sensors or anything, but it costs $10,000 to $20,000 now. If I have found a cheaper transcutaneous bilirubin, if you want it, email me and I'll tell you the name of it from China that I'm trying out now because I can't afford a JM-105. But I like it. And we're trying to do, that's some of what people are trying to do with those smartphone apps, is develop a cheaper transcutaneous bilirubin. So if you can talk them into giving us low-cost ones, we'd love it. And I have used it, and I will use it if I have a funded study. A little bit, but you can run a nomogram for your population and know whether it's reading high or low or just right. And that's what I recommend doing. Whatever TCB you're using, you ought to check a group of TCBs versus a true bilirubin at a place you trust it and see how they correlate. And you may need to add 3 or subtract 3 to be accurate, or 2 or whatever. Okay. Yes?
I have a question. So is it
It's pretty expensive for what it does. Now, if you have them, absolutely use them. And a lot of times with the severe jaundice kids, I'll turn a phototherapy unit on its side. So I'll have one on its side and one above the baby. If I have a Billy blanket, absolutely use it. But it's too expensive for the benefit it adds unless somebody's donating them to you. And then say thank you very much and take it. There are people working on low-cost Billy blankets as well. And so that may come to be. And there are, like, the Firefly is phototherapy from above and below. But that machine cost, I think it was $5,000. And, again, Clark is making low-cost LEDs for under $50, and so rather than buying the Firefly, I would have the top LEDs and the side LEDs. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anything else?
Thank you.
You're welcome.